Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now I want to talk with Ted Kessler. Ted has written a very funny and self-deprecating book called Paper Cuts. It's the inside story of the slow death of the British music press, but it's also a love letter to it, a tale of how music magazines saved one man's life. Kessler takes us on a journey alongside the stars that he interviewed and the workplace dramas that he navigated as a features editor at NME through the boomtime 90s and onto the monthly music mag Q in 2004, where he worked for 16 years before it folded with him at its helm as editor in 2020. So then, Ted, welcome to the programme. Ted, if the music magazines were the glue that held the love we all had for the music together, if I could put it like that, does your book Paper Cuts, do you kind of bear witness to the end of those times?
To the end of music magazines, I can, I'm afraid. I think, well, print media, certainly. I think it's the end. I think we can say goodbye to that. I mean, I do feel bad whenever we have this, whenever this conversation with anyone, because I am aware that Mojo magazine, for example, and Uncut magazine still exist, but they document extinct culture largely. So in terms of music magazines about contemporary youth culture and youth music, yeah, that's it, I'm afraid. We're done.
Okay,
we're
but like out. Ted, like the signs are on the wall. When you mention Mojo and Uncut, etc., they do benefit from focusing on the past, as you well know. You do not have a cover of those magazines without having it being Paul McCartney, Pink Floyd, or wherever it happens to be. Now, there's plenty of new news in there, but it basically does focus on the past. And all the new albums are reviewed as well, so it's something, right? But I'm just wondering.
I'm just wondering,
was Q dying anyway? I mean, if, for instance, Vox went and Sounds went and Melody Maker went and Select, which you worked for, went, and if all of those went and Enemy is now online, I mean, maybe like the writing was on the wall a long time ago, and I'm just wondering, did COVID kill it stone dead, or was COVID very handy to bury it?
Well, for Q specifically, which I can speak about best, it definitely killed it. I mean, Q was surviving before COVID. We'd sort of cut our cloth to survive. We knew we had at least another year. You know, we knew that we had the year mapped out financially. And then COVID came along and just wiped away 40% of our sales. So, and we were such a delicate ecosystem, 40% of your sales, that's it, you're dead. So we knew that we were done, I'm afraid. And the longer, we couldn't tell how long the lockdowns were going to go on for, so we didn't know when the magazine was going to get into shops again. And if you can't sell it in a shop, then you are done, I'm afraid.
Well, then what about, like, you know, the jollies of journalists and the trips they got and, like, this part of memory now? Like, has digital marketing, you know, videos on YouTube, the band page on social media, has it allowed artists and management, do you think, to bypass journalists, just go directly to fans, and basically online marketing got all the money and there's no press junkets, etc.?
There's none of that anymore. But, I mean, it is a short-term benefit for bands because there's no mythology being built. So, for example, when I think about Mojo in the year 2040 and they are trying to tell the story of the 2020s, they will have nothing to go on because there's no mythology being built around bands. And you're not telling the stories. You're not telling the not adding the shade to the pictures that the bands are putting on YouTube, etc. So, it's a really big miss, I think, in popular culture, and the bands will miss that too, and they're still, and I think they do miss it. I think that it's a big problem for young artists. How do they communicate with their fans? How do they have their stories told independently from them just going directly to fans? And, you know, we need that third party. You need that romanticism.
I couldn't agree more, but there's more than just romanticism too. There was just so much inside. Just to go into that, like, you know, there was a lot of times when I say mythologizing, but also putting the boot in. And putting the boot in as a reader, it was fun. I liked that. I mean, is it ever acceptable to put the boot in now? I mean, hatchet jobs from the past, there doesn't seem to be any place for it anymore.
I don't think there is any. I don't think there's any place anymore. And I actually, you know, I feel very guilty and very badly about any bad reviews I wrote when I worked for NME. Because I wrote a few, I worked for NME for 10 years, and I wrote a few really nasty pieces of work. And I feel guilt about that now. But I think in the present day, there's no room for it because with streaming, we can all listen to music. Yeah. So what your job is to point people to the good stuff and ignore the bad stuff. If you don't like something, there's no need to go and lay in so much hard work because just point people to the good
stuff. Yeah, maybe, but there was fun in it too, with all due respect. I mean, like, the amount of stuff that I read and had never heard or could never get a chance to listen to, like even reviews of kind of, you know, Bastard Kestrel at the Bristol Fleece and Firkin, I don't know anything, but I'll read it, and yeah. I liked it, and I needed that, and I'm not really getting that kind of thing now. So, you know, the function of reviewing, has it changed?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think it has changed, because you're not giving the thumbs up or thumbs down to things, because people can instantly discover them themselves just by Googling it. So you can hear that stuff straight away. And the gig world has changed so much that those little gigs don't really exist nowadays that you're reviewing. You know, I had lots of death threats I had three or four death threats at NME from bands you've never heard of who disappeared, whose career you may have ended just by being snide in the pages of the magazine.
Well, you know, a funny thing, Ted, is the fact that, like, people say, you know, you worked in the golden age of the NME, which was the 90s. No, you didn't. You didn't work in the 70s. That was the golden age of the NME, particularly the late 70s. Like, for instance, if Nick Kent gives a full-page review to something called Marky Moon by somebody called Television, like, I don't care, but I'm going to borrow, or steal that money. I'm going to buy that album. And then when I did, he was right.
Yeah, I mean, but that's, you know, we're just coming from different eras, you know, that was, he was right. We reviewed stuff too from our era that had import as well. I think there were the late 70s, the mid and late 70s NME was a golden period. I think the NME perhaps just before I arrived as well, actually, in the late 80s, early 90s was a golden era, and then it was really another golden era in the mid 90s, and then there was a massive fall off the cliff face until it righted itself. Ironically, just after I left in the early noughties, with bands like the Strokes and White Stripes around, I think that really helped them out.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt about it. The Strokes and White Stripes revived something, but maybe it was possibly a last gasp kind of thing. Let's go back 10 years, though, to where you were there. Like the whole Britpop thing and the whole Oasis thing in particular. I mean, you got a great kick out of all of that, didn't you?
The Oasis thing was brilliant, and the Oasis really saved us in it, and also destroyed music at the same time. It was a sort of massive, it was such a strong nuclear blast in culture that we made hay for a couple of years. It did actually kind of wipe out a lot of stuff too, and made everyone very serious about becoming hugely successful, which did take some of the fun out of it. But at the same time, during that period, there was also a lot of really good dance music, and obviously Chemical Brothers and Underworld, etc., and Orbital, and that was also a very exciting time, which I also wrote about. So I think what's often forgotten about that era is that it wasn't just Britpop. There stuff happening, and in America there's a lot of hip hop and Beastie Boys, etc. So it was a very rich pickings for the music journalists in that mid-90s.
By the way, we're talking with Ted Kestler. Paper Cuts is what it's called. How I Destroyed the British Music Press and Other Misadventures. There are a few misadventures in it, all right, but just to stay on that for a second about, you know, kind of massive ambition that Oasis had. Because of their massive ambition, or because of the overnight success, and it was pretty much overnight success, was it impossible, do you think, for those kind of interesting B and C division bands, who were always going to stay B and C, which is fine by me, by the way, was it impossible for them to almost, can I use the word, survive?
It was impossible. It was very hard for a lot of groups, certainly during that period between, say, late 94 and late 97, to have any room unless they were massively ambitious and wanted to take over the world. You know, it raised everyone's game, because hitting number 8 in the charts was no longer the pinnacle. You had to be number 1. You had to break other countries, and you had to be playing huge gigs. And I think for those, there's a lot of bands, good bands, who just couldn't actually make it in that light. But they, you know, then the tide went out, and then there was the late 90s, and we had a pretty grim period where there was no music. And I think that was probably because Oasis just blew the whole thing up.
The funny thing that you have about the Strokes, and you got to know them very well, is that, you know, the fame that they got, the minute they got it, Julian Casablancas, main man, he just fell out of love with everything, didn't he? He hated the whole idea of fame, possibly rock. How important for you was the Strokes?
Well, I think the Strokes came at a really good time. You know, we'd had Limp Bizkit, etc. We'd had that kind of new metal thing.
Yeah, dreadful.
And, yeah, exactly, dreadful. And I think music seemed pretty moribund at that stage. And then the Strokes sort of came with this sort of freshness, and you mentioned television a few minutes earlier. That kind of, you know, that arty bit too, that was,
yeah.
But also great melodies. And they were just enthralled to sort of rock lore, and they were messy young pups as well. And they were just, so it was just a perfect group, I found, at that stage. But that joy only really lasted for 6 to 8 months, and then I really do think, and I do mention this in the book, that I think that 9/11 changed it for them. And it was the same time that they had become as really successful, and I think they could not cope with it, and they never really survived that. Beyond that, I don't feel, as a proper functioning band. But for those 6 to 8 months, they were actually magnificent. Yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, worth remembering, quintessentially New York, of course, they were as well. Okay, so, you know, the music press, are we talking about a slow death here? I mean, I often look at it as Top of the Pops. Like, Top of the Pops needed to be put out of its misery. 10 years, I was still, like, I don't know why I was still there. It wasn't needed. So can I say it was a bit of a slow death of the music press because, yikes, am I really saying this? Because things like Q Magazine were not needed.
Oh, man. I mean, I think that Q Magazine was needed. I'm going to say that. And I do think that a lot of people in the music business in Britain certainly feel it was needed. And a lot of acts felt it was needed. And we felt that every year when we did the Q Awards, because we could get much, much bigger acts than we really had the right to do, considering our sales. We had everyone come to the Q Awards. And I felt that we reflected something in the culture that we were the only place that reflected that. So it was needed, but now it's gone. I don't think it can be replaced. So, you know, it's hard to say, really. It was coming. It was going to happen at some point, definitely. Yeah.
Do you rail against the whole online thing? I mean, so much undeserving nonsense is covered online, to quote. You know, and like, you know, you would be gazumped for exclusives as well, because they go elsewhere, the record companies, etc.
Well, it's mainly beyond the online. Yeah, online has the reach we haven't got, or we didn't have, rather. I'm still talking the present tense. Online has that reach, but you don't really know if anyone's really engaging properly with it online. I mean, we always had a problem with newspapers, which is another thing that happened after Britpop, was that newspapers suddenly realised that that bands could sell them copies. And so, you know, we had a lot of newspapers on our turf as well, and I'm not sure really how many people properly engage with that as well. So what we had at Q and what we had at NME and what the music press generally had was an engagement, and it was your religion. It was your, and you bought it religiously and read it religiously. Well, I don't think you do that with the internet, and you don't do it with newspapers.
I mean, basically the whole thing has been thrown into the pot of entertainment, and that takes away from the greatness of what we're talking about here. Or the exclusive club, exclusive, jeepers, the NME was selling hundreds of thousands at one stage, of course.
Correct.
So it was a nice big club. But I mean, you know, the stuff like, there was, your book. Do you think it's a post-mortem, or do you think it's a love letter, or both?
Oh, love letter, definitely. Post-mortem, that's not really my job. But this is a personal journey through the music press, and it's definitely a love letter. I mean, my whole life was shaped by the music press, from when I was a reader as a kid, as a very young kid. It was the most important teacher to me. And then when I finally got to be employed by it, I knew I was at home, and this is where I was going. And I worked within it for 30 years, so it's definitely a love letter. It's not like the post-mortem for someone else to do, I feel.
All right. Because,
too close to it.
You know, if you go back to 1990 and you saw your name in print first in Lime Lizard, you said, right, I've done it. This is for me. I'm going to do this. And then you were the live review editor for NME during Britpop, etc. Then features editor, etc. Then on to Q Magazine. And you never thought that you'd be the one to, how should I put this nicely, to go down with the ship, did you?
No, well, you know, I did fear when they offered me the job of editor. That was the question I asked the people offering me the job at Q. Would I be the last editor of Q? Because that's what I feared most of all by that stage. And they all laughed at me. And then I was right. I was the last editor. You know, when I started, you never see an end to this thing. But I did actually hope that I would get out earlier than I did, but I couldn't leave because I enjoyed it too much. It was the best working life I can imagine.
Do you know, Q magazine didn't do what NME did. Like, it was never sticking the boot in, never necessarily mean. But by the same token, there was a fantastic series in Q magazine in the first few pages for years, which was, you know, who the hell does X think he is, kind of thing. It was very good, and that certainly put the blinking boot in, I can tell you.
Yeah, I think that was, well, that was when it was done by a journalist called Tom Hibbert, who's no longer with us, but was a fantastic, fantastic writer. I had a real special acerbic tongue on him. And in the mid 80s, when Q started, it was particularly good. A little later on, it just started being a bit mean to people. There was a bit in the mid 90s when it got a bit from a formula for people just to hoodwink people. They would trick artists they normally like. So they'd have Bjork in there, people like that who they actually like and they needed, and they'd just be cruel to artists who'd be on the cover normally. So
Well, the funny thing is, like, the Hot Press here, Hot Press magazine, has been 45 years on the go and still going strong. And Pat Carty's in the current edition. He talks about your book and he says there was an era when humour, intellectual rigour, emotion, and the odd boot were applied to the important business of bullshitting about music. Now, to me, the two most important words thereof: important business. It was important business. It meant everything, right? The Bible.
Totally. It was totally the Bible, and that's kind of what I miss the most of all. And that is actually a very good review by Pat. He's a good writer. I totally agree that it was the most important thing I read. More important than any of the books I read when I was a teenager. It sort of formed my whole. Yeah, a whole view of the world. You know, the music press was vital.
And speaking that about the whole view of the world, I mean, like, sometimes it could be brutal, but it was always intellectually curious. Certainly, I always associated that with the NME in particular. And you know, it might have been politically left, but it's fair to say politically progressive.
But also, there's lots of competing voices and lots of competing egos within the paper. So, you know, there'd be people who'd be contrary, and it wasn't just one voice. I never felt the NME was speaking with.
Right.
One universal voice, you know.
I get the impression a bit in the book that, like, that there's in-depth kind of reasoning and analysis, if you read through the lines, of just how things could have gone so much better, or am I reading too much into it?
No, they're definitely, I mean, you know, lions led by donkeys as usual. That's the underlying message. You know, there was a lot of publishing missteps. There were a lot of people who worked in magazine publishing who probably should have been working elsewhere and probably wanted to work elsewhere. Then they didn't have the same passion or insight for print that the people who worked on the magazines themselves had. So there's a lot of mistakes made where it was just thinking about brand rather than product, and they made mistakes.
And from your point of view, your point of view personally, do you think music, pop music, was your psychiatrist in some ways? I mean, you had an absent dad and you had an abandoned family, if you like, and this sort of, I get the impression that this kind of was a good substitute.
Well, you could say that, but also when I had a fully functioning family, music was also my number one religion. I think it was just the music was just at that time in the late 70s, early 80s, when I was, you know, approaching my teens, puberty, etc. Music was absolutely brilliant, and I loved music. You know, every week there was a new amazing single by a group I hadn't heard. And so that it became my religion. But Paul Weller once said to me, "Music is my religion, and making is how I pray." And for me, music is my religion, and writing about it is how I pray. You know, it's very similar sort of thing.
Okay, well, listen, we're coming towards the end, Ted. And I haven't even mentioned. Okay, sure. Paul Weller. There was a fight there after the Stanley Road thing. Happy Mondays. Yeah. They abandoned you in Cuba, and then Manic Street Preachers in Cuba. My God, them were the days. But also Kevin Rowland. I mean, that's fantastic stuff in there. People are just going to have to read it. But, and it wouldn't surprise me either. Radiohead. The cover didn't go quite as planned. Tell me about that. Did they kind of, what's the word for it, embarrass you in public in front of a camera? What was it exactly?
Well, they'd had a few run-ins with NME, and I'd sort of been an unwilling participant in those run-ins. Like, it wasn't really my fault, but I'd just been the journalist when the music stopped. They just had a few covers fall out on them, and then on one cover I was interviewing them in Germany, and they were at this stage massive. And as I was interviewing them, a camera crew suddenly just turned up and started filming me, and then a year later, I became the butt of that joke when their documentary Meeting People Is Easy came out, and I was sort of cast as the bumbling, foolish journalist who's ruining their lives. When in fact they'd ruined mine, so there you go.
Right, indeed. And by the way, the other side of things is Paul Heaton, who is well known for being so good with the other people and people that he works with, and that he gave 35 grand to Q staffers when Q folded, didn't he?
He did. £1,000 for every year of Q's existence, and he only did it because he said that we'd helped him when he needed it, and he was going to do it. He was going to look after us now that we needed it. It was unbelievably generous, and I shared it out with all our contributors, who are all very grateful for that month's bills it paid.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, finally then, I mean, you know, I know you're going to say yes to this, but just hold on a second. Is there still a great deal of passionate and literate writing about music out there? I mean, like, some people point to the biggest one of all, which seems to be, I don't know, online, is Pitchfork. And I just think every single one of those people are up their own bums in some ways. They really need to relax.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I agree.
Yeah, but
I do. But what I will say that one beneficiary of the end of the music press has been music books, and there is a huge publishing industry now, which I'm gratefully ensconced in for doing books. And so I've never known more music books. I don't know how big the appetite is for reading £20 music books, but there are some real crackers out there, and every week there seems to be another brilliant
book. No
out.
Question about it, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same. You can't compare the two, I'm sorry, you know.
No.
And
no.
Just finally, one person said about the book that it's a rip-snorting account of a misspent youth well spent. That's perfect. It's a misspent youth well spent. It really has
Correct.
Been. Ted, you've been very lucky, and let's hope you continue to be so with New Q as well. That's C-U-E. You can get that online, of course. It's called Paper Cuts: How I Destroyed the British Music Press and Other Misadventures. And there's so many misadventures that I haven't spoken about there, not least stealing from your own bloody shop. That was a bit thick. Anyway, Ted, good luck. Thank you so much, Ted.
Thank you for your time. Cheers.
All right, bye-bye. Good luck. Bye.
Dave Fanning on 2FM.